I've asked Sandy if she would not be so kind as to share some insight that she has learned about boundary setting from some counseling in her background. And early on in the series, after class one day, she came up here to the board and she drew an illustration that communicates how she was taught about boundaries, which is one of the things that she mentioned to me was, it's like learning a new language. And, you know, you have to practice the vocabulary of a new language. You have to learn to think in this new language. And it's not something you flip a switch and suddenly you're doing boundaries. It's something that you learn. And so to provide yet another reason for the context of how we go about setting boundaries and having these conversations, Miss Sandy, would you come up and share with our friends what you told me about boundaries? And I'm going to give you the mic.
I could have learned anything about boundaries and it would be more than I knew, because I didn't know anything and I didn't have any. And I was in a counseling session, and I think most of you know that I have an excellent marriage now, and I wasn't smart enough in my early years to have picked wisely. And this particular counseling session was coming at a marriage counseling session before I married John. And I was trying to learn some boundaries. And as my counselor, Mark, talked about boundaries, he said that boundaries were like the boards of a sandbox. And he drew two boxes. And he said that inside the boxes, that was the sand. And this was my box, and this was my husband's box at the time. Keep in mind, this is not John. Okay. And he said, my problem was that there were no boards here. There were no boundaries. And you couldn't tell whose sand was whose. Now, this may or may not make a lot of sense, and maybe if I give it a little bit of context, it will. If I'm trying to tell you how to do something or what you're doing wrong, I'm probably getting in your sandbox as opposed to taking care of what I'm doing wrong and what I need to do. And that's exactly what was going on. I was looking at the other person's stuff or their wrong or their lack, and I wasn't looking at mine. And we have a joke now, John and I, because you don't just learn about boundaries and start applying them and, oh, well, you never have any other occasions. And there are times now where I don't always adhere to my boundaries. And John and I were, I don't know, we were sitting someplace, and I was trying to take care of some of his stuff. And I looked down, and he was going like this. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, getting the sand off my leg. And I thought about it, and I got so tickled. And he looked at me, and he kind of grinned. He said, aren't you sorry you taught me all this stuff? So that's my boundary story.
That's good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you, Sandy. I so appreciate you sharing that with us. What I'm doing today is part two of what I started last week about how to have boundary-setting conversations with people. And it's really kind of not just the words you choose, although I'm going to give you plenty of those, but the attitude with which you approach the conversation that you need to have with the person that you're going to set the boundary with. One of the things that we need to do in having any boundary-setting conversation is to affirm and validate the other person before you start messing with the sand in their sandbox. You need to affirm who they are and validate their value as a person and in your life. This is a biblical pattern. We see Paul doing it a lot in his pastoral epistles. where before he starts getting into problems with the churches, he would tell the churches what he appreciated, what was true, and what he appreciated about them. We see it in the book of Revelation. There are letters to the churches from the Lord Jesus. And if there was something good to say, he had that. He made sure to affirm the churches before he got in to say, now you need to correct this. So that policy, that approach of affirming and validating, because this person or this church or organization, whatever, is made in the image of God and therefore has great value, is a biblical one. It's not a manipulative way of pushing somebody's buttons so that they'll be open to you. It is a biblical way of showing honor and respect to other people. When we affirm and validate others, what we're saying is, I'm on your side. I'm setting a boundary here where you and I are on the same side and the problem is on the other side, because you and I have a relationship and you are important. And when we affirm and validate the other person, we're putting grace before truth. Truth is very important, but it needs to be wrapped in grace. And grace means favor. When we affirm and validate the other person, we're establishing that they have favor in your sight, and that you care about them, and that you believe in the person that you're dealing with before you're dealing with the issue. What happens when you affirm and validate somebody is that you're connecting hearts first, before you go on to the problem. And when you do that, then the person, it's a lot easier for the person to believe the problem is the problem rather than I am the problem. You see the difference? It helps a person not be defensive if there's a problem, but I'm not it. I'm separate from the problem. There's two different ways that Townsend and Cloud suggest that we approach the subject of affirming and validating. If there's just ongoing problem solving, it's really about addressing small issues where there's just, you know, it's some small thing that you're asking people to do. You don't need to make any big proclamation about your love and devotion to them. You're simply correcting a problem. And this is the kind of thing that we deal with in offices and certainly in homes all the time. And all of the things that I'm reading to you today that are in quotes are from their book, Boundaries Face to Face. Here's an example. Sarah, I love going to the movies with you. I really enjoy our time together, but you know, one thing that would make it better for me would be if we could leave on time. Because when we're late, I feel rushed, and I want to enjoy the time we have together. Which is, you know, this is no big gushing comment about how much your friendship means to me. It's a matter of saying, hey, Sarah, could we leave on time when we go someplace? Here's another one to a son. Joey, I like how you've been trying to do your chores. Would you look a little harder at the way you leave the den before you go outside to play? I end up picking up some things for you, and I don't want to do that. Thanks. Well, that's a very small adjustment that you're requesting. We validate other people with language that lets them know that we're with them and not against them. But sometimes it's a big, big issue. There is a major problem. And if it's a major problem, then it takes a major validation first to kind of soften the blow of what you're about to talk to them about. A little more proclamation, as they put it, is needed. Here's an example. Sarah, you know that I'm your friend and that I'm with you 100%. You know how much I value our relationship. Because of that, I need to share something with you that would make things better for me. You know, you're late a lot. The time we have together means a lot to me, and your lateness robs me of what I really desire, which is to have a good time with you. So I wanted to talk about it. As you can see, it's a bigger issue than, hey, Sarah, could we leave on time? You know, you're just kind of adding more information into the mix. Here's another suggestion. Jay, I like how much you care about the work we're doing. It's really contagious, and it helps me. But I want to make sure we look at an issue that's getting in the way of our working together effectively. And you're hearing these messages of affirmation and validation before you switch gears and say, there's something we really need to look at, and it's going to take some intentionality, and I'm going to need you to listen. Here's another one. Joe, you know how much I love you and how you're the most important person on the earth to me. I'm your biggest cheerleader. But something you do sometimes makes my heart sort of go away, and I want to talk to you about it. Well, that could be anything from a guy's pornography involvement to the way he talks to her. You know, that's making a very big statement of you're important, but this is really important too. Another one. Sam, I want you to know that the reason I'm bringing this up is because I love you and I'm committed to our relationship. I love and value so many things about you. In fact, that's why I have to talk about this. I'm missing those things because your drinking is getting serious and we have to do something. These are the types of scripts that they suggest that are patterns of dealing with issues, making boundary conversations and saying, we need to talk about something that is a problem. And these are some of the words that we can use. One of the things that is part of boundary setting is trying to decide when to set a boundary and when not to. And sometimes you can take an action in one situation that you wouldn't in another. One of my friends gave me permission to share a story that just happened very recently, that her daughter had fallen into some very difficult financial straits for no fault of her own. And because of that, you know, she was able to give some assistance. And she was delighted to do that. But then her daughter fell into other financial straits that were a direct result of choices that she made, character flaws, of saying, you know, I just really don't want to deal with that. Part of it was laziness, part of it was lack of self-control. And in grace in this situation meant saying, I love you. I believe in you. And I believe in your ability to figure out a problem to this solution. I'm not bailing you out, but I'll be here to walk through this valley and this trial with you as you work it through. And of course, this is a huge shock. It's going to be when you're expecting a handout and the handee says, no, sorry, I'll be with you in your trial, but I'm not going to be forthcoming. There's grace in that as well. With significant confrontations, it's really important to firmly declare your favor, you know, that you are for the person that you're confronting. It reestablishes that you are for them rather than against them, that where that line is in the sand, you're on the same side of the line. It establishes that connection that serves as the bridge between two hearts. And it enables them to get beyond their heart into their mind and deal with what you're specifically saying, not just the feelings of what you're triggering by setting a boundary. Do you see how affirming and validating someone helps us to carry out the second greatest commandment, which was love your neighbor as you love yourself? It's a very loving thing to do when we affirm and validate someone that we're having to set a boundary with. The Lord called us to be loving. And of course, sometimes, you know, people are hitting the manipulation buttons. If you loved me, you would fill in the blank. You know, you would give me the handout. You would bail me out of jail. You wouldn't make me go through this. You wouldn't make me have to deal with the consequences of my choices. Yeah, I do love you, and that's why I'm going to let you do those things. You know, we need to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. Another part, the second principle in setting boundaries, or at least for today, is to apologize for your part in the problem. One of the most powerful things ever said on confronting was about confronting someone's problems came from Jesus. And Townsend and Cloud suggest that this message should be in every psychiatry and psychology book ever written about relationships. Jesus said, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the plank out of your own eye and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." This passage speaks to another important dynamic in confrontation, which is the necessity of being humble and looking at what we have done wrong in the relationship and owning it first before we ever go talking to anybody else about what's going on. The principle is this. If you're confronting somebody, don't confront them if you owe them an apology first. Because if you owe somebody an apology, that's always the next right thing to do. The Lord Jesus said, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. The next step, if we owe someone an apology because we have sinned against them, the next step is always to go humble ourselves and offer an apology. You're not going to have a very good confrontation, boundary-setting conversation with someone if they're holding something against you, because you need to clear that out of the way. If the other person is aware of how you have hurt and failed her, and you're trying to talk to her about something that she's doing wrong, she's going to get stuck on thinking, well, how can you judge? You do such and so. And they're going to be stuck on, I can't believe you were talking to me about this little thing over here when you are doing this horrible thing to me. They're not going to hear what you have to say about the things that they're doing because they're still stuck on what you're doing. So you need to clear that out of the way first. Get that obstacle blasted off the path. But if you begin with owning and apologizing for ways in which you have failed the other person or for poor ways in which you have dealt with them in the past, then your humility paves the way for them to hear. It kind of removes the emotional earwax that blocks them from being able to hear what you have to say. When we apologize to another person, when it's deserved, it isn't, you know, it's not that everybody always needs an apology, but when and one is needed, what it does is, first of all, it lets the other person know you care about them. Secondly, it lets them know you're not there to lord it over them or be judgmental. Third, it lets them know that you're not there to win, because this is not a contest. And fourth, it models for the other person what humility looks like, and it takes away the shame that the other person might feel. Townsend and Cloud point out that if you have so much to apologize for that you can't do it in the same conversation as confronting them about whatever you have to talk to them about, then forget the confrontation and just have an apology conversation. Sometimes that's going to take a while. A well-done apology conversation, particularly if there's any size or depth to the damage that you've done, is going to involve an invitation to the other person to talk about what impact it had on them. I realize I have hurt your feelings. I want you to tell me how that felt. What did it do to you? What effect did it have? That's one of the things that we long for when someone is apologizing to us. We want them to know how it impacted us. We want them to know how much it hurt. And that's one of the most incredible invitations that any human being can offer another is, I hurt you. Please tell me about that. Can you imagine, first of all, the humility that it takes to do that? It's very, very hard. There's no room for pride or ego in a thing like that. But what you're doing is you're opening up your heart and you're inviting the other person to open up their heart and you're building a bridge between you and the other person. It is an incredible statement of love and care. So it's so important to start with an apology if one is needed. And when that happens, it is very common for that to open the door for the other person then to see what they've done. Because if the other person is totally in defensive mode and all the defensive walls are up, they're probably not going to see what it is you're wanting them to see to the degree that you want them to, because everything you're saying is being filtered through defensiveness. When you apologize first, it allows the other person to lower their defensive walls. Here's an example they give. Mary, I want to talk to you about the argument we had the other day. I didn't like how it went, and I thought I needed to begin by telling you that I'm sorry. As I thought about it after I cooled off, I could see I was way out of line in the way I responded. It was wrong, and I'm sorry for how I behaved, and I'm also sorry for how that must have felt to you. Will you forgive me?" What an incredibly lovely apology to make. And what you're doing, what that person is doing, is setting the agenda. I do want to talk to you about our argument, but first, I need to own what I did, and I'm sorry, and will you forgive me is a huge, very difficult, those are hard words to say, aren't they? Harder words to say are those three very, very powerful words, "I was wrong." So that's one of those things that's really worth passing on to children or grandchildren, is how to apologize by including the words, "I was wrong." If you learn to say them when you're young, it's a lot easier to say them when you're older. Did you know that? Some people, it's like their mouths don't know how to say, I was sorry. Oh, man, you're so close. There's something so powerful about hearing the words, "I was wrong," especially if we can teach that to boys. sorry, that was a joke. It's all, flesh is gender blind. Here's another suggestion that they give. "Joe, I want to talk about what's been going on between us. I want us to look at the ways we've been interacting and at some things that have happened, but I want to begin by telling you that I have reacted to you in a very hurtful and inappropriate way. I've been angry and judgmental much more than I've been helpful. I've nagged, been bitter, and even punished you for some things. I was wrong. I'm sorry for how that must have felt to you. Will you please forgive me?" Great apology. Here's another example. "Sam, as you know, I've been upset about some things you've done, and I do want to talk about them, but I want you to know something else first. I'm just as wrong as I've said you are. I've not held up my side of our relationship in some ways. I've come down on you way too hard and not really been your friend or ally in trying to resolve things. I lose it, and I'm not very helpful. I want to be more helpful and loving and let you know that I'm on your side. But I can see how you could not feel that way at times because of how I have acted, and I want to apologize for my behavior and my failure to be what you need." Those are great examples of apologies. For some people, coming across this information in a boundary book or hearing a lecture like this, that's the first time they've ever heard a real apology because it was never modeled to them in their home. Some parents seem to think that it would diminish their authority and their power as parents if they ever apologized to their kids for being wrong. And of course, the opposite is true. Children far greater respect and appreciate any kind of adult, but especially a parent who is willing to take ownership of being wrong. And it's very difficult for kids to learn to apologize right if they never see their parents doing it. There's no hard and fast rule about how to apologize first in starting a boundary-setting conversation. You can apologize and then go right into your issue. You can tell the other person that you want to talk about the issue right up front and then say, "But first I have to apologize for some things." There isn't an apology police waiting to issue you a ticket for doing it wrong. And the other thing is, you don't have to start every boundary conversation with an apology. A lot of the time, one is not needed. And so you don't need to make up something to apologize for. Women tend to be apologetic because we learn very early in life that an apology smooths feathers. And we can find ourselves apologizing for things that we never did wrong or try to take responsibility for somebody else's, you know, "I'm sorry that she did such and so." You don't. That doesn't make sense. You cannot apologize on behalf of another person and have it really mean anything. Apologies can go a long way, and they're very powerful customer service tools. You know, they really do matter. One of the first things I learned, 16 years old, when I was a long-distance operator for Illinois Bell. And at that point, if people got a wrong number, they would call the operator, and we would make out a ticket so that they would be given credit for their wrong number. And we were instructed to say, "I'm sorry. They were the ones who misdialed, but we had to apologize to them." And some of the other operators just really got upset. "I can't believe we have to say, 'I'm sorry.'" And I remember even at that point realizing, I'm not taking responsibility for their mistake. I'm offering sympathy that they were inconvenienced. Okay, I can handle that, you know. There's a difference. And I'm really glad I learned that lesson at an early age, because I have said I'm sorry to people in response to when they've said something. Give me an example of something difficult that they went through. And I'll say, oh, I'm sorry. And they'll say, it's not your fault. I'm not taking responsibility. I'm just showing compassion, or, you know, acknowledging that you went through a rough time. They go, oh, it's as if they never knew the difference. But back to the subject at hand. If you are aware of ways in which you have failed the other person, deal with that first. It'll do a lot of good, and it may give the confrontation a very, very different tone. Another concept in setting boundaries is to avoid shoulds. When you say should, it's the same as pointing a finger and jabbing it in somebody's chest. You can't say, you should do this or you should have done this, without the other person feeling very defensive. Because you may as well say, you're such a failure, you're such a screw-up. You should is full of condemnation and judgment. Some examples. You should have thought about this beforehand, because then this never would have happened. You should plan better. You should write it all down. Then we wouldn't be in messes like this. When you hear these statements, how do you feel? Guilty? Ashamed? Angry? Or do you think, wow, what helpful input? I wish that person could follow me around and evaluate everything I do. Probably not. The word should feels very parental and judgmental to people. When you say you should, you're placing yourself in a one-up position, as if I know the right thing to do and I'm looking down on my little pedestal and I'm telling you how things should be different. If you're talking about the past, saying you should have doesn't give the other person many options other than to see how they blew it. They'll often feel, okay, fine, now I feel awful. What do you want me to do about it? It's done. I should have done better, but I didn't. So you're right. I'm pond scum. Now, that might be extreme, but you get the idea. It reinforces the other person's feelings of failure and shame. It is not in the least bit helpful to say, you know, you should have done this. You don't get, it's a dead end. It's a blind alley. You don't give them any place to exit that place, that emotional place, with any dignity and respect intact. It's much more helpful to put things in question form. Let me ask you a question. If you had to do it again, what would you do differently? Now that is a gracious way of inviting someone to look at the past in a redemptive sort of way. Because if we look at the past, at the lessons we learned, and say, man, I wish I could have done things differently, and we own that we made a mistake, but I've learned from it, what a wonderful positive spin to put on that. If you ask somebody, if you had to do it again, what would you do differently? That is such a better way of asking, what should you have done? Again, that word should is a trigger that's going to make people feel defensive. If the other person's stuck, and by the way, these types of conversations when you're looking at the past are often between parents and children. It's not often that you find yourself in a position to have the right to ask this question of somebody who's a peer. But if the other person is stuck and you're asking them, what would you do differently? You can say, may I offer some feedback, or may I make a suggestion? Because you may see things very clearly and they don't. But asking, may I make a suggestion or may I offer some feedback, is a very respectful way of saying, I have something to say about that if you're interested, because it gives the other person the right to say no, thank you. Now you may, if somebody asks you, would you like some feedback on that? And you may feel compelled to say, well, sure, go ahead. But you don't have to. Part of setting boundaries is learning to say no, thank you. One of the things that you could say is, you know, I'm not in a place where I can receive it right now, but I'll let you know if that changes. Now, that that lets both people hang on to their self-respect. Because if somebody said, I have some feedback about that if you're interested, a wise person might well say, well, sure. You know, go ahead and give me your input and your feedback. You're never promising what you're going to do with it. But sometimes people's plates are completely full and there's no more room for anybody else's opinion, especially if you're caught in a difficult setting and a difficult place and everybody and their brother is telling you what to do. And people who are hurting find themselves in that place a lot. And they just don't have any patience for a single more unsolicited piece of advice. So you can say, you know what, I'm not in a place to hear it right now. But I'll let you know if that changes. Well, that's maintaining your boundaries and saying, I acknowledge that you want to give me what's in your heart and in your head, but I can't receive it right now. It's kind of like if you're at a restaurant and your coffee cup is full, if they come around and try to fill it, it's already full. You don't have any more room for more coffee. It'll just make a mess if you keep pouring. So you just kind of put your hand over your coffee cup and say, no, thank you. You have the right to say no, thank you if somebody wants to offer you something you don't want. When someone says you should, people feel their choices going away. Instead, you want the other person to freely choose to do what you're suggesting. You want the other person to feel good about it and not forced into it. Because if you feel forced into something, that's manipulation. That's what God does. He brings us to a point where we are the ones who freely choose to do what is right because the alternative is such a bad idea and it's going to hurt. Or we're not going to like the consequences of our choices. God sets things up, says, I give you this choice. You're not going to like what happens if you go in this direction, and this direction you will eventually. The choice is yours. God always leaves the choice up to us. Joshua, in the Old Testament, preserved the freedom of the people of Israel when he said, if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living. Joshua told them to serve God and be faithful to him. But he also said that if it were disagreeable to them to serve the Lord, then they were free to choose whom they would serve. He preserved their choice. He was clear about what he thought was the right choice. He said, as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. But he didn't try to force them to serve the Lord. He didn't try to force them to make the same decision that he knew was the best decision. In good relationships where it doesn't get in the way, using should is okay. If you've got a close relationship where there is no defensiveness because there's total acceptance and a good, strong, healthy relationship, you can say should and it doesn't trigger anything. For example, in many husband-wife relationships, it's real easy to say something about, you know, you should do it this way and it'll work better. And the other person won't respond in a defensive way because they completely know that you are for them, that you're not judging them, and should is not a trigger word. It depends on the relationship. For a lot of people, should is a trigger word. If you say, you should do it this way and it'll work better, what they hear is, here, let me help you get out of that bind. Turn the handle to the right and you can get out of that basement you're locked in. And it's, you know, it won't trigger anything negative. But if you don't have that kind of relationship with someone and you say, you should do it this way and it'll work better, can sound like, you idiot, if you were turning the handle the right way, you wouldn't be stuck down there in the dark. You know, and people can ascribe messages of condemnation when we never intended it that way. So it depends on the kind of relationship you have. To the pure, all things are pure, the Bible says. You know, it kind of depends on where people are coming from. Nonetheless, if you kind of strike the word should out of your vocabulary, that's probably a good thing. Townsend and Cloud give some suggestions on how to say things better. And this is the kind of assistance that I so appreciate because learning new scripts, new ways of saying things, I find very, very helpful to tweak ways of being gracious. Scripture says, let your speech be seasoned with grace, as it were with salt, so that it will, you know, do good stuff in the ears of those who hear. And these are ways of seasoning with grace. Here's a not so good way to say something. You should have called me and told me you were going to be late. Now you've ruined the whole night for me. I could have used the time to do something constructive instead of waiting for you. A better way to say it would be, you know, it would have really helped me if you had called when you knew you were going to be late. Please do that next time so I can make use of the time. Now, one is much easier to receive than the other. One is full of condemnation and pointing fingers and, you know, you make me mad and you're not a very nice person. And the other is, when you did A, I felt B, which is what we talked about last week. When you did not call me and tell me you were going to be late, this is the impact that it had on me. Please don't do that next time. Reasonable request. Here's another example. Not so good. You should get up early, read the paper about new jobs, and get ahead of the game. You should also be making more calls. You're sitting around so much that you're never going to get a job. You should have been out there looking all this time, and you've just been wasting your time. Which a lot of wives say when their husbands are out of work, or a son. Here's a better way to say that. Things would go better if you made some changes. You would have more success, I think, by getting an early start and using the days to find the work you agreed to seek. It seems as if you're letting valuable time slip by. There's no should, there's no pointing fingers, there's no condemnation. Another example, not so good. You shouldn't hang around with those kids. You should be finding better friends, and you should not be out anyway. You should be here doing your homework. Should. Here's a better way of doing that, of saying that. I don't think that group of friends is good for you. Some of the things that they're into are things I don't want you doing. And it's tough to avoid falling into things when you're around kids who are doing them. Let's talk about what's going on, why you're there, and what you think about it all. And also, I want you to do your homework first before going out, no matter who you're with. So finish that, and then let's talk. No should messages in there, and yet still communicated. Another example, not so good. You shouldn't be drinking so much. You should focus more on me and the family. You like your beer better than us. A better response. I'm concerned about your drinking. It's becoming a problem, and we miss you. When you drink, the kids and I lose you, and we don't want that. Townsend and Cloud suggest that we watch our use of the word should to make sure that it's being heard correctly as the helpful way in which we mean it. If we use it punitively or as condemning or controlling, or if it's heard that way, then we need to change the words and our tone of voice so that there's another approach to having this boundary setting type conversation with people. And then the final principle I wanted to share with you is to be specific. When Ray was, did I tell you the story about when Ray was in graduate school working on his doctorate, about his dissertation? Did I tell you that story? No, I'm seeing blank faces. Okay. Ray has a PhD in molecular biology at UTD. After years of absolutely fruitless research work in the lab, nothing that they tried worked. Because God has made his creation in such an incredibly fine-tuned way that you can't manipulate genes and make them do what you want. And they kept running into the natural limits that God had put into his creation. And after a while, he just ran out of time, and they had to give him his PhD because, you know, after 8-9 years, you know, he was done. So he was the first person in the history of the University of Texas at Dallas in the biology department to write a negative dissertation, which is basically saying, this is all the stuff we did, this is what we tried, and none of it worked, and here's why. It was a very difficult time. Well, before he began his dissertation, he went to his major professor and he said, I need to know what you're looking for in a dissertation. Would you please point me to the library? Give me some ideas of what you feel is a good dissertation and what would please you. And I need to know what I'm shooting for. I need to know what standards you're looking for. So would you give me some help along that line? And she said, no, I've never seen a dissertation that I like. He said, you're not going to give me any assistance? No. Okay, she just said, just start writing. So he would start writing one chapter at a time. She would turn back to him, marked with all these red marks, change this, change this, change this, and he would change it, and he would write a new chapter and send that in, and he would make the changes. And by the time she'd had like a couple weeks to look at things differently, she'd say, change this, which it was like change it back to the way you had in the beginning, because she didn't remember. She didn't know what she wanted, so she didn't know when she saw something that she liked. It was impossible for Ray to get any specific input on what was going to please her. He didn't know what hoops were going to work because she didn't know what hoops were going to work. It was impossible to please someone who refused to be specific on what it would take to be okay. It was one of the most frustrating times in his whole life. Which is why we need to tell people exactly what we want them to do and what it is we want them to change that will make us happy, that will help the relationship. We need to be very specific about what our expectations are. So instead of saying things like, I want you to connect more with me, that is very vague and nebulous. We need to say things like, honey, I want to go for a walk with you, and I want you to tell me what's going on at work, and I want you to tell me how you're feeling about it. Well, those are very specific behaviors. Go for a walk, talk to me about what's happening at work, talk to me about your heart. How are you feeling about these things? Those are very specific things that's giving direction on this is what I want. Here's another example. Marty, I want us to sit down and talk about our dreams and where we want to go from here. When can we do that? Other people have had conversations. We need to work on a budget. When can we sit down and crunch the numbers and put everything out on paper? We need to have specific time to talk about the specific issue. Another type of boundary setting invitation. I want to know how you're feeling lately. I want to know what you think and feel about us, about our relationship. I want you to tell me what it is that makes you feel good about us and what makes you feel not so good about us. Those are very specific requests. We need to be specific when we're asking something of someone. So here are some specific suggestions about how to be specific, as opposed to global, which is way too, I want you to be better. How do you know when someone has achieved that, okay? Here's a global request. You're so irresponsible. I need for you to be more responsible around here. That's way too unspecific, isn't it? Here's specific. I feel as if there are a lot of times when you leave things undone. I want to talk about your paying the Visa bill on time and taking care of the car insurance payment like you promised. Let's talk about how to resolve this. Well, those are very specific things that a person can check off their list. Here's a global request. I want to feel more loved. That's not going to communicate. Here's specific. I wish you would tell me you love me at times other than when we have sex. A lot of wives have needed to say that. There was a point at which I said to Ray, I would really like for you to be more romantic. And I would love for you to bring me flowers for no reason. And I would love for you to give me a card just out of the blue. And I would love for you to call me up just to tell me you love me. And I gave him specific things that I wanted him to do. After I got over the illusion that if you have to ask for it, it doesn't count. It's like, and who made up that rule? That's like saying if you're hungry and you go to the restaurant and you tell them what it is you want, that doesn't count because the guy from McDonald's didn't come out into the middle of the road and flag you down and say, you want something to eat? You know, you ask for what you need. You ask for what you want. It's legitimate. Particularly because God is the only mind reader there is. Other people, especially men, are terrible mind readers. And so we condemn people for not reading our minds. That is so not fair. Another global accusation. You're so mean to me. I'm tired of your verbal abuse. Well, how's this for specific? When you get angry at me and yell like you did last night, it hurts. I want to know that you can see how hurtful that is. Well, that's much more specific. You're pointing to a specific event. Last night, you yelled at me. Sometimes with some people, you may even have to tell them exactly what they said because they don't remember. Particularly when people are red hot angry inside, when you are overcome with feelings of anger, it's like it shuts down the rational part of the brain. And a lot of times you're not thinking and people don't remember. Particularly angry men seem to be that way, although there have been known a few women that way. And they honestly have no idea what they said. All they were feeling was that red-hot anger. And so sometimes you may need to tell them, this is what you said, actually, and this is what you yelled. Oh, no, I never said that. Do I need to tape you? You know, because some people honestly don't realize how hurtful they are because their brain has shut down and they are running off their brain stem of the emotions. Another global statement. You treat me like an idiot. You act like I'm so stupid. Here's much more specific. When you don't talk to me about our finances, like the refinance application the other day, I feel as if you think I'm too dumb to understand. And when I don't understand something and I ask you a question, like about the insurance claim, you didn't answer me. You grabbed it out of my hand and said I was dense. I want you to talk to me about specifics. And if I don't understand something, please answer my questions without putting me down. Please treat me like a partner, even when I don't know everything you do. Much more specific, much more helpful for what was unacceptable. Particularly when you're dealing with another person who comes from every marriage is a cross-cultural marriage, right? We all come from our own different cultures in our families. And in some families, what is unacceptable in one family is the way everybody deals from a day-to-day life, you know, in another family, and they have no idea that it's not acceptable. In some families, name-calling is the way you treat. You never use a person's actual name. There are things, you know, hey, butthead, you know, that's the way, that's how they treat people when they're mad and when they're being affectionate. That's the way they do it in their family. And then you've got other families that if you say the slightest thing with even an edge in your voice, it feels like a mortal wound. Those two people generally end up marrying each other. And there needs to be some understanding of, you know, when you do A, I feel B, you know. And some people need to develop a thicker skin and others need to just pull back and stop doing things that are obnoxious. One final suggestion, global statement. You always do this. You promise me you're going to do something and then you forget about it and leave me hanging. This happens every time I try to depend on you. Now, if the person really wanted to please the other one, how would they know what they were talking about? They wouldn't have any clue. But if they heard this, I need to know that if you tell me you're going to do something, it will get done. Yesterday, you promised me you'd get my prescription filled and you didn't. Now I'm without my antibiotic and I'm afraid I'm not going to get over this infection before our vacation. And it also happened the other day with the form I asked you to mail. I want to talk about what we can do to make this better. I love you and I want to trust that you'll do what you say you're going to do. Well, those are very specific suggestions and anecdotes about this didn't work. Let's talk about it.